Well, I'd also like to echo the thoughts and say thank you for the special music. Sarah leaned over to me and she said, I could listen to a whole CD of this. And I think she was talking about Instead of Me. It's too late now. Well, let's jump right in, shall we? Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4. Let's just start off right in the Bible. Not a bad thing to do here on this holy day. We're going to start by recounting here an early biblical story. We're going to be reading Genesis chapter 4. And although... I know, I'll be done in a minute. You don't have to send me off yet. Although this is just a few short chapters into the Bible, quite a lot has already gone on. There's a tremendous amount of activity that has occurred from the recreation of the world to the first man and woman to Satan making his grand appearance as a deceiving snake. We're going to pick up the story here in Genesis chapter 4. We're going to start in verse 1. Genesis chapter 4, starting verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was the tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of fruit of the ground to the Lord. The Bible is oh so famous for using just a few words to describe big, expansive things. We don't know how much time had elapsed here between verses 2 and 3. Certainly there are many that speculate, but apparently the two boys had grown up enough to the point where they were responsible for their own offerings and had control and responsibility over their own actions. Verse 4. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. There was something about the attitude of Cain and his offering that when it was presented, it was not pleasing to God. And almost like when you were disciplining a child and you're explaining to them what they did wrong, and then they start to get angry with you. And you say, well, wait a second, why are you angry at me? This is your fault. This is what you are doing wrong. You are in the wrong here. I kind of get that same feeling here. Cain is angry at God and or Abel about the result of his offering not being accepted. Verse 6, so the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? So this is God's response to this singular individual event. But notice how God then broadens the lesson almost immediately into an interesting life principle. Notice this, verse 7, if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you shall rule over it. Sin lies at the door. The funny thing about sin, if you can call it funny, I guess, is that Satan has a variety of techniques for getting sin in the right place at the right time. Or maybe, I guess, the wrong place at the wrong time. Sin is not always like a SWAT team, where they come up to the door, they blast it open with a battering ram, they throw in the stun grenades, and they come in with guns blazing. Sin here didn't jump up in Cain's face here, start taunting him about Abel, trying to stir the pot. It was there, sitting quietly and patiently at the door, just waiting for an opening. Well, you know the story. The next verse has Cain, sometime in the future, maybe immediately, maybe longer, rising up against his brother and killing him. By that time, he had already opened the door and let sin walk right in. Today, we're going to talk about sneaky sin. Sin that doesn't announce itself when it comes to the party. Sin that avoids clashing on the cymbals and blowing on the trumpet when it's ready to interfere with your life, but rather the sin that lies at the door. Sin that quietly slips in through the cracked window when your attention is elsewhere. Sin that blends in with the crowd, and then, before you know it, has its tentacles wrapped around various parts of your life. I dare say that most of us will confront this type of sin much more often than a large, egregious sin. It's probably been a little while since we murdered somebody. We probably don't go out and steal regularly. We remember the Sabbath. I mean, we're here after all. But what about after Christ expounds the spiritual concepts on the Sermon on the Mount? What about anger, lust of the flesh, pride of life? What about those slippery, nuanced sins that seem to reappear from time to time? What about those? Let's jump forward a few verses in Genesis, because there's another example here, very close by, that shows how incredibly pervasive sneaky sin can be and how deadly the consequences often are. It's the story of Lot. We'll pick it up in Genesis chapter 13. You've again heard this story many times. If you've forgotten, you can ask a small child. But let's come at it from a slightly different angle, because there's a principle here tucked in that can go unnoticed. Genesis chapter 13, picking up in verse 1. Genesis chapter 13, verse 1. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him. To the south, Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. Abram had a great deal of physical blessings even at this point in his life, and that included livestock, the currency of the day, along with silver and gold. Dropping down to verse 5. Lot also, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now, Abram seems to be the more dominant partner of the two, but nevertheless, Lot himself was quite well off as well. He had his own flocks and herds. In addition, he had lots of tents, indicating that he had servants as well. Both of them traveling together had become a logistical challenge. They were together too big and too numerous for the land to have them commingled. So it was time for them to separate. Verse 6, now the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites dwelt in the land. So Abram said to Lot, please, let there be no strife between you and me, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please, separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right, or if you go to the right, then I will take the left. So here the men separate. They go each their separate ways. Lot chooses what appears to be, at first glance, a great place for flocks and herds and whatnot. He picks the plains in the region that encompassed a large area, enough for his cattle, but even included the city of Sodom. Then time goes by. Lot gets taken captive. Abram goes to rescue him. Abram becomes Abraham. Ishmael's born and whatnot. The march of time continues over the years. Sometime later, Abraham gets a visit announcing the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham knows that Lot is there, at least in the general vicinity, but then they have a conversation about saving the city if they come across a certain amount of righteous people. You remember this. Now, how many were in Lot's original family? How many herdsmen, shepherds, family members, and whatnot were in that party when they separated so many years ago? There had to be at least 50 of them, right? I mean, 45? 30, 20, surely 10 at the most, or at the least, rather. After all, how many people were in Lot's own family? Well, when we get to chapter 19 in the story, time has brought on some interesting changes in Lot's life. I doubt any of them suddenly. He's now in the city, a city that he knows very well is bad, since he drastically tries to take the angels inside and undercover. He then offers his daughters to this riot that breaks down his door, or attempts to break down his door. Let's pick it up here in verse 12 of Genesis chapter 19. Verse 12 of Genesis chapter 19. Then the men, these are the angels coming to evaluate the city. Then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Son-in-laws, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in this city, take them out. Get them out of this place. Now, we'll remember the context. The riot has just been blinded supernaturally. There's chaos. There's panic. time is of the essence for sure. Verse 13, for we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord. And the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws, who had married his daughters, and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But to his sons-in-laws, he seemed to be joking. And notice the next verse, because I think this really highlights what had happened to Lot. When the morning dawned, so we've gone through the night here already, so when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife, your two daughters, at least them, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. Lot's urgency was waning. He was not hustling like one would expect for what just happened to him or for what the angels told him was about ready to take place. Verse 16, and while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and probably Abraham too, and brought him out and set him outside the city. Well, this Lot is different than the one that parted from Abraham years and years prior. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, you don't need to turn there, calls Lot a righteous man, seemingly at odds with what we read. The UCG Bible reading program says, quote, though a righteous man who was severely troubled by the depravity of the people of Sodom, he was nevertheless corrupted by it. Maybe he was there thinking that he could help the city for the better. Maybe he simply got desensitized. But regardless, little by little, year after year, the circumstances changed to the point where Lot almost had to be dragged out of one of the most corrupt and sinful cities that even today is the example we use for pure terribleness. Let's talk about sneaky sin that awaits by the door. And let's focus on this and how the days of unleavened bread can help us drill down on this type of sin. And we're going to use these two points along the way. Point number one, becoming slaves to sin can happen slowly and almost imperceptibly. Point number two, the days of unleavened bread give us the template in finding hidden sin. Let's start with point number one. Becoming slaves to sin can happen slowly and almost imperceptibly. Moses was sent to free the Israelite slaves out of the land of Egypt from hard bondage. It says that they were required to work in great rigor and that they were afflicted, but it wasn't always like that, was it? And it certainly didn't start like this either. The slavery that the Israelites experienced took a long time to take root. The way that the Egyptians did it was interesting because I think it can parallel how sin works in our lives, slowly, slowly over time. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46. Before the Israelites complain in the desert, before the pillar of fire leads them across the dry riverbed, and before Moses is sent to free them from bondage, they had to become slaves in the first place. Genesis chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46. Joseph is in Egypt, long since sold into his own slavery by his brothers. He's risen through the ranks. He's put in a position to help save many people by gathering extra during the years of plenty to provide for the years of famine. Here in chapter 47, he gets finally his extended family out of Canaan to join him in Egypt. It wasn't just him and his brothers. It was a large family. They couldn't just crowd inside of a minivan, you know, put the seats down. But they had a large family and possessions, numbering 66 people that came with them. And they all wholesale uprooted and resettled in Egypt. Let's pick it up in verse 28 of chapter 46. Genesis 46, verse 28. Then he, this is the patriarch Jacob here, sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, now let me die since I have seen your face because you are still alive. Then Joseph said to his brothers and his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. So they have brought their flocks, their herds, and all that they have. So it shall be when the Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servant's occupation has been livestock from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. So a couple things to point out here. The family wasn't rich, but they were surviving, especially here during the famine, the best that they could. Joseph directs them to the land of Goshen. This exact location is disputed, but best guesses puts it around the Nile Basin, within relative proximity to modern-day Cairo. The land was suitable for their livestock to graze upon, and also good enough for them to provide for themselves during the remaining part of the famine, with some help from Joseph. Pharaoh questions them, and hearing that they are shepherds, redirects them to Goshen to be all by themselves. The rest of the Egyptians didn't really want anything to do with them and their profession, so as a result, they were able to set up their own community. They didn't have to be separated from one another. They weren't forced into a strange world with strange customs or into slavery immediately. Instead, they were transported intact into a pretty good situation, actually. In the next chapter, chapter 47, we'll pick it up in verse 11. Genesis 47, picking up in verse 11. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Then Joseph provided his fathers, his brother, and all his father's household with bread according to the number in their families. So at this point in time, the extended Israelite family was doing okay. They weren't a powerhouse, but they were taken care of. They were in a spot to grow, and not just a spot where they were struggling to survive. Dropping down to verse 22 of chapter 50, Genesis chapter 50, verse 22, we're skipping through this story pretty quick. Genesis chapter 50, verse 22. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir and the son of Manasseh were also brought up on Joseph's knees. So we have several generations here. Joseph dies, but the families continue to grow. They've now put down roots here. They've set up communities. They've built houses. They've made long-term plans. They've grew big families, had new children. And it's easy to skip over the time frame that we're talking about in these verses, but several hundred years have passed by. Whole generations have come and gone. They have their flocks, their gardens, their lifestyle. But then slowly their situation began to change. Let's move to Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happened in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh's supply cities, Pithmoth and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they, the Egyptians, were in dread of the children of Israel. Verse 13, so, and this is after they were initially afflicted, after they had continued to grow and grow, so the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick, and in all manner of service in the field. And all their service which they made them serve was with rigor. Again here, what's not mentioned is that this took lots of time, from being left by themselves to simply being dealt with shrewdly, to having various afflictions, to having taskmasters over them, to finally having their lives being made with bitter, hard bondage took a lot of time. Generations of time. It was a slow process. They weren't uprooted, moved to a foreign land. They didn't have their families separated or torn apart. It wasn't like a switch that was flipped and they were suddenly in harsh oppression overnight. Finally, when they had reached their breaking point and cried out to God, he answered them and sent them Moses. But of course, even after Moses was born, it was still another 80 years before God sent him back to free the Israelites. That's a long time, 430 years in total from start to finish, which is almost twice the time of the entire lifespan of the United States of America. When Moses freed the Israelites from bondage, they were thrilled to be out from the harsh taskmasters in Egypt. But they weren't ready to wholesale change everything, for there were some things in their previous life that they liked, that once it was missing, they longed for. They might have been ready for God to intervene, but they weren't ready to submit to God and his new way of life. The mindset of their life in Egypt was thoroughly baked into their psyche, mixed in over generations and generations. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 11 for a telling observation. Numbers chapter 11, we'll start in verse 4. Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. We're breaking into the context here. The Israelites are out of Egypt at this point. They've come through the wilderness. They've come to Sinai. They've stayed. They've disobeyed. They've left. Now they're on the verge of sending the spies into the promised land. So that's where we are here in this story. And frankly, a good portion of their way through it and some of the very last interactions before the original Israelites were denied access and forced to wander another 40 years in the desert. So here we are, Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. Now the mixed multitude, Numbers 11, verse 4, who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat?" Remember, they're eating manna here at this time. Verse 5, "We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up, and there is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes." Now, what were the Israelites talking about? They were getting manna supernaturally from heaven, but they had these intense feelings of homesickness, thinking back to the land of captivity in Egypt, where they had access to cucumbers and melons, leeks, and garlic. If we turn to the New Testament book of Acts chapter 7, we have a good summation of this. Acts chapter 7. This is also breaking into the thought here of Stephen's speech right before he was martyred. And he has some commentary on Moses and the mindset of the Israelites. Acts chapter 7, we'll pick it up in verse 37. Acts chapter 7, verse 37. This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear. This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us." Verse 39, "whom our fathers," the Israelites, "would not obey, but rejected. And in their hearts, they turned back to Egypt." Or maybe in their hearts, they never really wanted to leave fully. "Saying to Aaron, 'Make us gods to go before us.'" You know, the gods like they used to have. "As for this Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So they made a calf in those days, offered sacrifices to the idol, and rejoiced in the work of their own hands. The Israelites were so immersed in slavery, in so many different aspects of it, that they weren't ready to fully turn and commit to God. The slavery to sin had snuck in all aspects of their lives, and getting rid of it was a task that they were never quite able to fully accomplish. Much like Lot's wife, as they crossed the Red Sea, they were still looking back figuratively, reminiscing about that old way of life, their old gods, longing for those cucumbers, the leeks, and oh, the garlic. For us, we have similar issues. I know that I do. Issues that creep in over time, become habits, small things here and there that we have trouble shaking off and keeping away, things that have become integrated into our lives over a long period of time, The Apostle Paul had some thoughts on this too, didn't he? Let's go to Romans chapter 7, starting in verse 15. I think we can relate to this. Romans chapter 7, starting in verse 15. For what I am doing, I do not understand. I feel that way too sometimes. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For the will is present with me, but how to perform what is good, I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. That last line is not to say that the Apostle Paul was taken over by some parasite and lost his free will, that this sin parasite made him do it. And he had lost control even over his objections, kind of like the old saying that the devil made me do it. No, that's not what's going on here. It's the same battle that we often face. I know that I do. That you can feel the draw of sin pulling you away, and often very subtly and very effectively. If there was a strip club right outside the Hawthorne Center, I saw a lot of heads perk up when I said that. But if there was a strip club right outside the Hawthorne Center, not one of us would feel much temptation to exit church and just walk right in during happy hour, even if they were serving unlimited matzos. That's an obvious sin. Of course, you're not going to fall for something like that. But how much easier is it to be drawn away when you're reading something that seems innocuous or watching something on TV and inappropriate sexual imagery starts to get sprinkled in? It's much more subtle, but no less harmful. And sometimes it can be, oh, so much harder to get rid of. Romans chapter 7, verse 21, just the next verse here. I find in a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. Sin can slowly drift into our lives over time and in small enough increments that it can be hard to root out. Hard even to notice it's there sometimes unless you specifically look for it. But once we do find it, once we come to the realization that we have some sinful habits lurking in the back of the closet, well, then we have to deal with it, don't we? And that brings us to the second point today. Point number two. The days of unleavened bread give us the template for finding hidden sin. The days of unleavened bread give us the template for finding hidden sin. It's clear that the days of unleavened bread as a holy day, and like all the holy days, were designed to be instructive for large periods of time. It wasn't just that the Israelites left their yeast starter kit on the shelf when they ran out the door and God decided to make an example out of it, but rather this holy day was planned to be a tool not only for the immediate lives of those Israelites, their generations to follow, but as a spiritual principle forever. Let's notice this in Exodus chapter 13. Exodus chapter 13, we'll read verses 5 through 9. Exodus chapter 13. Verses 5 through 9. And when we do read this, let's take notice of how God planned for this holy day to be used as an instructive tool. Verse 5, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. So this was designed for years into the future, Perhaps none of them knew that it would take quite as long as it did to get into the promised land. But it's clear that this was not just a one-off celebration, but rather had a purpose over time. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth, literally, in a sense. For with a strong hand, the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. Well, even though we understand that the days of unleavened bread are designed to be illustrative and a teaching tool, it's still really quite unique. The days of unleavened bread is a really big concept packaged in a really small item. Leavening is so small that it's really kind of hard to visualize. Some of the other holy days come with big images about big events to come. When we think about trumpets, we think about Jesus Christ's return to the earth and what a powerful show that will be. Or the eighth day, when seas and seas of humanity will be raised from the dead. Even Passover, we can visualize the death angel passing through the Egyptian lands or part of the great suffering that Jesus Christ endured on our behalf. But for the days of unleavened bread, we are told to visualize a small bit of dough, and even more specifically, tiny little microorganisms that eat impossible-to-see sugar and excrete impossible-to-see gas. Taking sin out of our character, which is perhaps one of the most important concepts of our spiritual lives, is related to something as common and as everyday as a slice of bread. And you know, I think there's something to that. How does, practically speaking, the holy day, this holy day, help in finding hidden sin? How is unleavened bread unique in this way? Well, let's think about what we do during this holy day. We are required to perform specific actions before and during the holy days, as you well know. And if you're like our family, you do several things. First, you go around and you take stock of your situation. You take inventory of what needs to be eaten or thrown out before the days start. You plan a course of action. You get prepared. Not only do you look at the food you have on hand, but you make plans about how you're going to eat during the holy day time too. You tailor your grocery plan. You customize your meal plan. If you have kids in school, you figure out how to maximize their embarrassment with matzos. All of this requires foresight, planning, and of course, preparation. The spiritual principle to this is obvious, so we're not going to dive into this aspect, but the preparation is clearly reinforced within our spiritual life as self-evaluation leading up to the Passover. We're to organize ourselves spiritually. The next course of action is right before unleavened bread starts. 2 days before, maybe 1 day before unleavened bread starts, you gorge yourself on any remaining leavened products in the house. I couldn't find a spiritual parallel for that, so we're going to skip that one. But then, once the sun sets and the holy day begins, you start fresh. There's no leavening in the house. There's no mistakes have been made yet. You are clean at the beginning. To get unleavened, you have to start new. You can't take leavened dough and try to take out all of that leavening. Once it's in, once it's mixed around, it's in. You have to throw out the old and start again from the beginning. Let's notice what David says in Psalms chapter 51. Psalms chapter 51. I'll start as you're turning back there. Again, that's Psalms chapter 51, starting in verse 1. To the chief musician, a psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet went to him after he had gone in to Bathsheba. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions. Okay, so we have to remember the context of this psalm. It's a pretty low point in David's life and his poor choices with Bathsheba. His bread, at this point in his life, had been thoroughly leavened. So now what? Verse 2. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Drop down to verse 7. Purge me, verse 7, with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me hear the joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins, and blot out all my iniquities. And this next famous verse, you know it. Create in me a clean heart, O God. And renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold me by your generous spirit. David was asking God for a restart, a fresh slate. He wanted, just like we do when we sin, for God to remove the iniquity from him so that he could start clean, fresh dough, so to speak, that has no leavening in it. Once the week rolls on, the days of unleavened bread also force us to do something else. Be deliberate in our actions. We read labels. We look up ingredients. If we go to a restaurant, we oftentimes look ahead to make sure that we have things that we can eat there. In other words, you take more time than normal to be very consciously aware of your eating habits and your actions. Well, dare I say, though, that God is less concerned about the great care we take in avoiding hidden sodium bicarbonate in our afternoon snack. Although that's important, he's much more focused on the great care we take in avoiding sinful thoughts and behaviors. The days of unleavened bread are the physical template of a spiritual concept. Romans chapter 11 expounds on this. Romans chapter 11, you can turn back there, we'll start in verse 1. Romans chapter 11, starting in verse 1. It says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now, obviously, that doesn't happen automatically. That takes deliberation and effort. Dropping down to verse 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Then the writer goes on to list specific courses of action for when we're going that extra mile and replacing wrong reactions with proactive godly responses. Verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourself, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will reap coals of fire on his head. Then the chapter ends here with one of the greatest oversimplifications of all time. Do not be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. You cannot even come close to fulfilling the scripture without taking extra care, deliberate effort, and paying close attention to your spiritual condition. The days of unleavened bread give us the template in a physical sense on how to do this on a spiritual level. Highline, which is a long-form project from the Huffington Post, recently had a long article entitled Mothers of ISIS. The concept has been turned into a play in London as well, so it's kind of out and about now. But it follows mothers of children, mostly men, but not exclusively men, that fled their home life and went to join ISIS. Some of the mothers had come together to form a support group and try to get resources and understanding as they dealt through the situation. And what I found most interesting about this story was how normal these kids' lives were. And these young adults, how normal their family life was. Now, obviously, they had problems here and there, of course. But the mothers they talked to were largely from middle-class families, leading a largely middle-class life. And as these mothers shared their stories about what happened within their families and to their children, striking similarities appeared. Even across countries, cultures, races, socioeconomic boundaries, the children that left to join ISIS typically followed a very familiar path. There wasn't any one switch that was flipped. It was usually a family member or part of the community that filled a very small void. And this void was left unattended and grew slowly over time. But then it also slowly got filled with a different philosophy. Several of their mothers commented about how they could see subtle changes here and there, but the entirety of the problem wasn't clear until it was way too late. And you and I might think, well, I mean, what do you mean? How could you not see your own child change like this? A normal child turning into a radical jihadist. But when something is slow enough, gradual enough, it can be hard to notice. When sin sneaks through the door, just slowly over time, you might not even notice that it's there. Not at least until it leavens into a much bigger problem. When King David walked across his rooftop and glanced over to Bathsheba, sin was waiting at the door. He took small steps, and then a few bigger steps, and finally a couple giant leaps into sin. It wasn't until the prophet Nathan figuratively shook David by the shoulders until he realized how integrated that sin had become. When the Israelites left Egypt, they were thankful for God's physical deliverance, but they weren't ready to be freed from spiritual slavery. After so many generations and generations, the way of life that they were living was so integrated into their being that when God parted the Red Sea, led them with a pillar of fire, and when his booming voice frightened them to death at Mount Sinai, in the back of their heads, they were still thinking about the garlic, about the leeks, and about the cucumbers. Yeast starts incredibly small and slowly, but it consistently and thoroughly grows until there is nothing left for it to consume, or something kills it. There is no alternatives. You can't take yeast and just isolate it in the corner of the bread and have it not take over. Sin can be big. It can have neon lights flashing and lighting up the whole night. But sin can also be small, sneaky, resourceful. In all cases, sin is deadly. The days of unleavened bread remind us that sin needs to come out of our lives completely, all the way. And it gives us a physical template that we can use spiritually. We do have to go to God constantly for a new start, a fresh start, so that we can attempt to keep sin at bay a little longer. And if you're having trouble visualizing that spiritual principle, God gives us a simple, everyday, run-of-the-mill piece of bread that you can use as an example. Can you keep that sneaky sin out of your life? Can I keep it out of mine? Sometimes. Hopefully, a lot of the times. Tonight, after sundown, you're welcome to have a large four-topping flavor-encrusted pizza from Pizza Hut. I recommend the hot pepper crust. It's my favorite. Pack in all the leavening that you want there. But tonight, after sundown, and every day that follows, let us hunt down that sin and keep it from sneaking in and leavening our spiritual lives.